ferromagnetism. I will quickly run through the mean field treatment of it. I've already told you we know the exact ground state. But then we'll move on to excitations, which are these magnons or spin waves. And we'll use Holstein-Primakoff transformation to do that, which is sort of a general way of doing things. I think you will look at the same problem in the tutorial for antiferromagnetism. And then I want to move to the Hubbard model, and in whatever time remains today, I want to tell you about the Hubbard model. First, because it actually reduces to this model, and second, because it's sort of the paradigm for strongly correlated electron systems. So it's nice to know something about it. Let me just warn you again that in the modern day, usually the Heisenberg model is written with a plus J out front. In Ashcroft and Merman, it's written with a minus sign. And that this is written with a plus sign, but in Ashcroft and Merman, it's written with a minus sign so that the M is going to be G mu B times S. So this is Ashcroft and Merman. So normally there's a minus sign between the moment and the spin. So we'll deal with this one. So I've put in the minus sign explicitly now, so there's no ambiguity here. It's clear that we're dealing with a ferromagnet because I've chosen this to be minus a positive quantity. And we're going to continue with this minus sign here. So in the mean field approximation, one looks at these spins over the entire lattice, and since this is dotted with its neighbors typically, then those neighbors are regarded as a mean field. That's basically the approximation. And or another way of saying it that is that you replace each of the spins by its expectation value. So in this case, we could choose any direction we like, but since I'm thinking of a lot putting a field along the z direction, very often we choose the z direction. And then the fluctuation terms don't contribute here, the s pluses, s minuses that are in this formalism. And one gets that H. Heisenberg, that this Hamiltonian just reduces to a constant, which is minus JH times S squared, because you'll get an S from each of these. And then you'll get an N, the number of spins involved. And if we're doing nearest neighbors only, we'll get the number of nearest neighbors divided by 2. So this notation means nearest neighbors only. And the other term gives us a minus mu b times n times s times b, the applied field. So this is the exact result. As I said, when we put all the spins aligned at their maximal value of s, in the z direction, then we'll get that ground state result. But we want to look beyond that. And so we write, well, I won't go through the details, but instead of writing this, we write SI is equal to SI average plus SI minus SI average. So I add and subtract this. This is the sort of the mean field, and then this is the fluctuation away from the mean field. So in those fluctuations away from the mean field, this would be written as minus sum over I, SI dot I will write it as be effective. Okay, and so the mean field now just looks like a magnetic field. And usually we put the G minus mu B. So G here is we're going to use 2, but this can be computed. This is the part we skipped in chapter 31. If these spins aren't just intrinsic angular momenta, they're actually J's, which consist of a combination of the angular momentum and the intrinsic momentum, then these G's can be are a function of J, L, and S, and they can differ from 2, but for us, we'll take G going to 2. And so we've written this as an effective field, and this effective field is obviously any applied field. So here, it will again be aligned in the z direction just by choice, or if we have an applied field that is in the z direction, that will dictate that that will be in the z direction. So it'll just be this actual field plus the field represented by the neighboring spins. And for that, we will get a JH. We will get a factor of 2, because there are two terms basically here. There's when you concentrate on this term and look at its nearest neighbors versus focusing on the second term and looking at its nearest neighbors. And then there are the number of those nearest neighbors, z over 2. And then we divide by g mu b, because that's out front here. And then we put the actual value of s. Okay, so we're again, this is the mentality we had with the Hartree-Fock approximation. We're taking a complicated mini-body problem where there are interactions, two-body interactions, and we're replacing it with a single particle Hamiltonian with an external potential, if you like, or an external field, which represents the effect of all the other particles. And you'll see in a second where we're going with this, because if we use this relation here that M is proportional to S, we can rewrite this as B plus JH times Z times M divided by G mu B squared. So one of the questions we want to ask ourselves is, what is the magnetization that results from this model? And we've changed the model into a one-body model with an external field that depends on the very thing we want to calculate, which is M. But we know how to solve this problem. Again, in chapter 31, if we looked at the problem of an atomic spin, there we called it J. So this is the problem of an atomic let's call it well, let's call it spin in quotes because now I'm using the J notation, in a magnetic field, well, then the moment that we computed there was minus di F by di B, and F was minus K Boltzmann times log of the partition function. So the M was simply K Boltzmann T times 1 over Z times di Z by di B. And the partition function here, since this is aligned in the Z direction, the partition function is a sum over all states of e to the minus beta En, but the En's here are simply the eigenvalues of this problem, which are, this is an operator at this point, but the eigenvalues are simply minus G mu B times JZ times B, where JZ is equal to minus J plus 1, dot, 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 all the way up to J. So it takes on the two J plus 1 values. So Z here is equal to the sum of JZ equal minus J to J of e to the minus beta times minus G mu B JZB. Okay, and that's a finite sum, and you can do it very easily, and you will get e to the beta G mu B times B times J plus a half minus e to the minus beta G mu B times B times J plus a half divided by e to the beta G mu B times B over 2 minus e to the minus beta G mu B B over 2. Okay, so that's the partition function. And so we put that into this equation for the magnetization. So Z is computed right here. We put it in here. We take the derivative. And we will get M is equal to G mu B times J times, I'll skip a lot of steps here. Times hyperbolic cotangent of x times 2j plus 1 over 2j minus hyperbolic cotangent of x over 2j. Where x is g mu b times beta times j times b. Okay, so that's the general theory of atomic moments in the presence of a magnetic field. And we want it for J is equal to S is equal to a half. Then this, by the way, is known as the Brillouin function. and as a function of x. So x has in it the temperature, beta, if I write it out explicitly, it's over k Boltzmann t. It has the temperature in it, and it has the field in it. So you can think of that as a function of field or inverse temperature. But this bj of x looks something like this. It saturates at 1. And this is for j is equal to 1/2. And then for other j's, it basically does similar things. It grows from 0 and saturates at 1. So, for example, when the temperature goes to 0, then this whole function here goes to b of at infinity, which is 1, and we get the magnetization saturating now at its full value. Okay, so as the temperature goes down to 0, then you're going to end up with all the moments aligned, right? Which is sort of what appears natural when I tell you that the energy levels are given by this quantity, then clearly you'll just get full alignment. Jz will take on the full value J. Whereas in thermodynamics, when you're at finite temperature, you're going to have a distribution of those states occupied. When J is 1/2, so the 1/2 times 2 cancels, you end up with M equal mu B, and then this thing reduces to the hyperbolic tangent of X. Okay, and then an X is equal to mu B times B over K Boltzmann T, because the G and the J, which is 1/2 now, cancel. So that's an aside. What do we have? We have B effective, going back to this expression up here. So when we calculate the magnetization for that problem, we get M, and let me bring the mu B over to this side, we get M over mu b equal to hyperbolic tangent of x. X is mu b over k Boltzmann t times b effective. But b effective is b plus I'm going to put s equals 1/2. So it doesn't matter. I'm going to use this expression anyways. Jh times z times m over 4 mu b squared. So I put g equal to 2. I don't really want a field. I only put it there to guide you, because everything you do with the field now you do with b effective. But in the end, I don't really want a field. I want to ask, if I just lower the temperature of this material, what happens? And so now I've got m equal to the hyperbolic tangent of something proportional to m. So if I let y equal jh times z times m over mu b over 4k Boltzmann t. If I change variables like that, then I get this becomes 4k Boltzmann t over jhz times y is equal to the hyperbolic tangent of y. And if I simply plot the solutions to that, so that's a transcendental equation, if I plot versus y, hyperbolic tangent of y is just a function that does this. It saturates at 1. So this is hyperbolic tangent of y. And then the left-hand side is just a straight line. Well, what's the slope? The slope is, for high temperatures, the slope is going to be very large. T is in the numerator here. For some temperature, which I will call TC, the slope equals 1, because the slope of hyperbolic tangent is 1. That's why I pick on that value. And then for lower temperatures, I get a solution. Y1 for T1. And then for still lower temperatures, I get a solution of Y2 for T2, and so on. So first of all, that critical temperature is defined by the slope being 1. That's just this prefactor equaling 1, and so, or right here. So I get TC, K Boltzmann TC, if I do it in energy units, is simply given by JH Z over 4. So like I said at the very beginning of last lecture, or the one before that, I can't remember, when I told you the magnetic interactions were fake, they didn't come about from the dipole interactions, because I estimated the magnitude of the coupling in that van der Waals interaction, and it was of the order of 1 degree Kelvin. So that would play the role of JH here. And your TCs indeed come out to be of the order of that coupling constant, 1 degree Kelvin. And that's completely wrong. In real materials like iron and nickel, the critical temperature is of the order of 1,000 degrees Kelvin. And that's telling you that this coupling is of that order as well. So this is mean field. This is by no means exact. But this is the critical temperature as given by mean field theory. We mentioned last time the Ising model and various models and how Onsiger solved the Ising model. To sort of round off that story, the three-dimensional Ising model is not solved, except numerically on small lattices. And the 2D Heisenberg model, which is what we're looking at here, is also not solved exactly. You can't solve. In the case of the ferromagnetic interactions, you can get the ground state, but you can't solve the general problem exactly. The one-dimensional Heisenberg model, as I mentioned last time, is solved. So we've obtained this mean field critical temperature. Along the way, we could have solved for the magnetic susceptibility. I mentioned that in the first lecture on magnetism. And what we would have found here, so we would have found some constant over T minus TC. This is for T greater than TC. And remember, I just quoted the result. We didn't work through it. But for paramagnets, for materials that don't undergo some kind of transition, we got Curry's law, which was some constant over T. So if I plot those, so I'm now plotting the susceptibility. So without deriving it, I'm telling you that here we get the susceptibility to be a constant divided by T over TC. So we get something like this, where this is TC for a paramagnet, we get C over T, some other C. So this one here was a ferromagnet. And you get C over T minus TC. And I might as well add, while I'm at it, that for for an anti-ferromagnet, you get C, some other constant, over T plus T Nl. So there's a Nl temperature, which tells you, and I don't know if you're going to work through that today, or no, but you'll do the Holstein-Primakoff transformation that we're going to study in a second for the anti-ferromagnet, and that will consider spin waves away from the ordering that occurs, which is this naive up-down spin ordered state that I mentioned. And the susceptibility will look like this. So it will not diverge. If you could go to negative temperatures, it would diverge at minus T Nl, but of course you can't go to negative temperatures. For this case of the ferromagnet, we can now plot this magnetization that I've computed by graphically here, but you can compute it with a calculator. And it will be zero above Tc, and then it will rise and approach a saturation value. So this is Tc, and this is versus temperature. So this is the ordering that occurs in a ferromagnet. You can work out that this goes like Tc minus T to the 1/2. And these exponents are a subject of huge interest in the 60s and 70s, these critical exponents. This half is a feature of mean field theories. The actual exponents are measured with great care, and they're not a half. They're more like a third or something like that, depending on what's called the universality class. But that was a topic of great interest then, less so now. And of interest to us now is that this magnetization normalized to its zero temperature value deviates exponentially. And the temperature here is in the denominator, so when I say deviates exponentially, it means it's exponentially flat. So it hardly deviates at all. This thing starts going down only exponentially. And that's wrong experimentally, but that's what you would get by just doing the mean field theory at this level. Why is it wrong? It's wrong because we have not considered other possible fluctuations, except that this, you know, when we wrote it as the mean value of spin plus deviations, we haven't considered these spin waves, and that's what we'll do next. Any questions up to this point?
What will change for an antiferromagnetic?
What would change?
Yes.
You want me to start working on the tutorial problem? What would change is there's this staggered. So there's a staggered magnetization. So instead of simply writing this, you have to write, the ordered state would have to reflect the fact that it changes for every site. So the ordered state is something like minus 1 to the I times S. Okay? Where I, you know, is 0 here, 1, 2. So every time it's even, you'll get up spin. And every time it's odd, you'll get a down spin. So instead of having a magnetization
you'd have an M sub A and an M sub B, where A refers to this sublattice, which is this, this, and B refers to the other sublattice. Okay, and instead of M sort of depending on N, you would have MA over here depending on just MB, because the only nearest neighbors to the A sublattice are B sublattice spins. So you have an equation like this where MA depends on MB over here, and another equation where MB depends on MA. Get these two coupled equations. That shows up in the Holstein-Primakov too, I guess.
Yeah.
So you'll see a bit of that. You're not going to work through this though, right? You could work through the version of this for the antiferromagnet, and that's what you would get. And then you'd have to solve those two equations simultaneously, and it's not really that much harder than this.
And is there any relation between TC and TN, or definitely is something totally different?
No, there's no. Well, for the antiferromagnetic problem, way up here, where I wrote minus J absolute value JH, you would have to write plus absolute value of J and L. Now, so I'm not sure what, and then T and L would certainly be dependent on J now, very much like TC is dependent on J sub H. Now, if you're asking, is there any relation between this J sub H and the J now, the answer is no, in general. They're completely different systems, and the fact that the sign has changed tells you their physical origins are very, very likely very different. So now, as it turns out, as I briefly showed you those tables from Ashcroft and Merman last class, and you know the T and the L's tend to be lower, almost by an order of magnitude in value, the ones we see in nature compared to T current TC. So that is also an indication of the origins. Today, at the end of the class, I hope I'll talk very briefly about the Hubbard model. The Hubbard model describes electrons that move around in the lattice. There is one limit of that model where the electrons decide they shouldn't move at all, they should just stay put, and therefore it becomes an insulating state. But as we talked about it last time, when you've got electron interactions, and now you've got an insulating state, there's this huge degeneracy. What do the spins do? And for the Hubbard model, it's very clear what the spins will do. They will align antiferromagnetically. So the Hubbard model reduces to the Heisenberg model in that limit. Okay, and it reduces to that J. The J that sits out front there, which I've called J sub H here, but the J in the first line, which can be positive or negative, for the Hubbard model, turns out to be 4T squared over U, where T is already that Hopping parameter that we've introduced in the tight binding models that tells you a little bit about the kinetic energy, and U is a typical, you'll see it's an on-site electron-electron repulsion. But it's what you get from the Coulomb interaction when two electrons are close. So that U is a large energy. And that's a sort of a more microscopic derivation of what the magnitude of J is. Okay, any other questions? So we're going to look at spin waves, also called magnons, and there's been a proliferation of names, because you also see paramagnons or or ferromagnons or anti-ferromagnons to apply to those specific cases, but this is sort of, we'll just call them spin waves. And we're going to deal with the ferromagnet here in particular. And we're going to deal with the ordered state. We're going to use the Holstein Primakov transformation. So Holstein is the same Holstein that studied electron phonon interactions. This is back in 1940. And actually, the general theory of this was done by Julian Schwinger in 1965. So there's more detail there. So you start off, let me remind you what these spin operators do. So SIZ acting on a state characterized by its total S and its Z component of S, what does it do? It just gives you the number SIZ. And SI plus acting on this state gives you, I'm leaving out H bars, gives you SS plus 1 minus SIZ, SIZ plus 1 acting on a state whose angular momentum has been lowered, the Z component has been lowered by 1. SI minus which is something similar this was plus 1, sorry, the SI plus raises the Z component, SI minus lowers Z. So, because Holstein and Primakov knew that these excitations were spin waves, and they wanted to rewrite this theory in terms of those excitations specifically. They wanted to think of them as bosons, which I told you is last time is already a correct way of thinking about them, because you can see them in neutron scattering, and you can characterize them like you do phonons. Then, what they said is, let's think of this state here as a state of bosons. So these are boson occupation numbers, just like you have in phonons. And what is the boson in this case? The boson is the deviation from a full spin. So the number of bosons you have are going to be represented by S minus SIZ. If the state you're acting on here is fully aligned in the, so it's SIZ is S, then this is zero because there are no excitations. It's in the aligned, it's in the ordered state. So there are no excitations, this is zero. If this is down by one, so if you've got a completely ordered state, but then this one here is down by one, or if it's spin a half, it goes all the way down there, then for that guy, there's an excitation, and you want that to be one.
But you can't pile up excitation. I mean, right? It's balanced. My point is, n is only going to take a few values.
Excellent. Yes.
So how is that?
Absolutely.
That doesn't sound very bosonic to me.
That absolutely. It's not. It's a spin.
Okay.
So the point was raised. It's absolutely correct. That this can't be exact because in the case of phonons, by temperature or by some other stimulation, I can create as many phonons as you like. I can create 3,000 at a particular site. But if I've got a spin 3/2, and they're all aligned at 3/2, I can create an excitation that moves that down to 1/2. I can create another one that moves it down to -1/2, and then I can create a third one that moves it down to -3/2, and that's it. I can't go beyond that. It doesn't go from 0 to infinity.
Because it's not fermionic either, so might as well.
No, it's not fermionic either.
Might as well call it boson.
No. The it's not a question of calling it bosonic. We know what they are. They obey the spin algebra, right? So
sure.
So all these, what are they? S plus, S minus is 2SZ, I think. And SZ, S plus, minus, S minus. Right, these are sort of what define, let me see if I have those. I don't know if I have them written down.
Yeah, that's maybe the two or three.
This is
yeah, S plus S. Yeah. So that you can raise and lower.
So this is the algebra that governs spins. If these NIs are BI daggers, BIs, then the algebra that governs these is that they obey commutation relations. And actually we're going to make a transformation that preserves this. So that's not sufficient. Anyways, the as you point out correctly, this can't be exact. And it isn't. But remember the mentality we had with the, for example, the Debye model. With the Debye model, we had a dispersion curve that looked like this, and we replaced it with a dispersion curve that looked like that, and we got the low temperatures behavior correct. That's the same thing here. If we're thinking of the deviations at low temperature from zero temperature, we don't have to get the full problem right. We just have to get the problem of the low line excitations. If I have a spin, even if I have a spin 1/2, by the time I start exciting 2 magnons or 2 spin waves, that means I'm already much higher in temperature. Okay, at first, at low temperatures, the one thing I'm going to excite mainly are the single spin waves or single magnon excitations. But it's a very correct point, and it's good to point it out. So there's all sorts of motivation, but because of time, let me not dwell on them. Let me just say that the representation they used is SI minus would be the square root of 2s times the square root of times bi dagger times the square root of 1 minus ni over 2s. And SI plus is going to be square root of 2s, 1 minus ni, 2s, times bi. And SIZ, I've told you already, is simply going to be S minus ni, where in all of these expressions, ni is the number operator for these bosons. So when you lower one of these ordered spins, that's what happens with SI minus, you are creating a bosonic excitation, a away from the ground state. So you get this creation operator, even though it's SI minus, and SI plus destroys those executions. So what can you do? You can actually use these relations to work on a state that has, for example, a spin flipped down. And then you can, instead of using that SI minus operator, you can use this one on a state that has one excitation. And then you will find that acting with this thing actually gives you back what you've got there in the feedback. So the way they act on the single magnon states, if you like, is identical. Okay. So I don't think I'm going to go through demonstrating that. And you can also show that if you use this in these expressions, so substitute into these expressions, obviously if you substitute the real spin operators, you would get them back. But if you substitute in instead the Holstein-Primakov transformation, and then use this, you get all these correct. So it works well on many fronts. And now it's a simple matter of, well, I haven't actually written the Hamiltonian. But if I write it out, it's SIZ times SI plus delta times Z plus 1/2 SI plus times SI plus delta minus plus SI minus SI plus delta plus. If I now, well, let's substitute that in. I get S minus NI, S minus NI plus delta, plus 1/2. SI plus is square root of 2s times square root of 1 minus ni over 2s times vi, and then I get square root of 2s vi plus delta dagger times square root of 1 minus ni plus delta over 2s. So just plugging that in, plus, right here, plus SI minus, which has the square root of 2s VI dagger, square root of 1 minus NI over 2s times VI, square root of 2s and square root of 1 minus NI plus delta S times VI plus delta. These are all operators. I need NI VI, which is NIVIVI dagger VI. So I think it's minus VI. NIVI dagger VI dagger. So with that in hand, I can work through all this and I will get H Heisenberg. So let me skip all these steps. Is a constant, so there's a constant piece represented by this S times S over here, and that's it, which is the E naught. It's the same E naught we wrote over there, plus J. Now, I better write it to make it explicitly. J is minus some absolute, some positive quantity. So I'm going to write it like I did there, because we're strictly doing a ferromagnet now. So let me put that in there. There's going to be an S, and then there's going to be a sum over I and delta of BI dagger BI plus BI plus delta dagger BI plus delta. Right, so that's coming from these two terms, the cross term here and the cross term here, minus BI BI plus delta dagger minus BI but BI dagger BI plus delta. Plus a order BI to fourth, or BI dagger to fourth. Okay. So I'm expanding the square roots, and everything else is going to turn into a BI to the fourth. And if memory serves me correctly, you're not, well, it doesn't matter, I guess. It does. You want to get the BI dagger BI by itself. So you have to commute these things through to get those corrections beyond. Because you never know that you might not generate another term through the computation. Once you have this form, you're home free. It's quadratic. You're ignoring the rest. And that, again, Olivia, that's sort of part and parcel of the comment you made. Yeah. So that's sort of consistent with it. You now write a transformation and use Q. To wave vector space, and same for BI, and so this becomes E naught plus J H S times 1 over N sum over I E to BI sum over I sum over Q prime of E to the I Q minus Q prime dot RI, and then sum over delta. Now you have a 1, you have an E to the I Q minus Q prime dot delta, and then you have a minus E to the minus I Q prime dot delta minus plus, and then minus e to the minus I prime delta prime bq dagger. This thing here gives you delta qq prime, and so you end up with some constant plus J sub H times S times sum over Q. And let me skip a bunch of steps here. This will you four sine squared q delta over two times q dagger. So in the end, it's equal to E naught plus sum over q times omega q dq dagger. And it looks just like the phonon theory, except the phonon, the dispersion for these magnons is 4 times J sub H times S times sum over delta of sine squared Q delta. Okay, so, and that dispersion I can draw, and it looks something like this. This is omega q, so this is the Brillouin zone, and it will depend on direction in general, but down here it will all be the same to go at q squared. Remember the phonons were linear in q, these are quadratic. And how many of these magnons do we have around? The number of magnons are governed by the thermal expectation value of n sub q, and that, because we've treated them as bosons now, will just be the boson distribution. So if we ask about the magnetization as a function of temperature, we get the zero temperature, the ordered magnetization, that you know, the, where they're all up, and that value we've computed, it would just be the g mu b times s times n. But now we're going to subtract the number of magnons we have, which is well, g mu b times this n sub q, which is 1 over e to beta. So this could be written as m0 times 1 minus 1 over s, 1 over n, sum over q of 1 e to the beta omega q minus 1. So m of t over m0 is equal to 1 over s. So remember, 1 over n, sum over q. Well, let me do it differently. Let me insert here an interval, the omega of delta omega minus omega q. Right? Because then the 1 over n sum over q of this delta function is the density of states. So we end up with just an interval from 0 to infinity of d omega times d omega. And we're allowed to change this omega q to omega now. Anybody tell me what the form of the density of states is? In three dimensions?
The square root?
Yeah, square root. It's square root. And remember, the reason why you know that is because we did it for the electron theory with dispersion also was k squared. In that case, here it's q squared. When we did the Bayes model, it was different. It wasn't square root of omega because the Bayes model dispersion is linear. So as soon as you know that it's like this, then I can make a substitution of x equals beta omega, and I've got a factor there, and I've got a square root factor there, so I've got a 3/2 factor here times integral 0 to infinity of dx, some constant a, which is up here, which we could work out, but I'm not going to bother with, square root of x over e to the x minus 1. That's just a number. I don't care what it is, what I do slightly, but it's just a number. And so I end up with, this is 1 minus this, I end up with 1 minus some number times t to the 3/2. 1 over beta to the 3/2 is t to the 3/2. So this is called Bloch's t to the 3/2 law. And instead of having this exponential deviation from 1, which came out of the mean field treatment, we have a deviation which goes like t to the 3/2, which is a lot more significant. So if you do the experiments and you plot m of t over normalized with 0 temperature value, this is 1, and now motivated by this, you plot the data versus t to the 3/2, you should get a straight line that looks like this. And indeed, when you look at the experimental data, so this is one of the plots I whisked up on the PowerPoint slides at the end of last class. And it was confirmed in some materials fairly early on. So that's the Bloch 2 to the 3/2 law, and that is a result of the spin wave excitation. Okay, any questions? Notice what I said last time. If you were doing this in 2 dimensions, what's the density of states? It's a constant. I wouldn't have the square root of x. And what happens to this integral when x goes to 0? So it's like 1 over x, it diverges. So this spin wave theory fails. It doesn't for antiferromagnets. I don't know if you'll derive this. Yeah, you probably will. When you do the Holstein-Primakov transformation for antiferromagnets, then up there you'll find out what omega sub q is, and you'll find it's linear in q. The fact that it's linear in q changes everything from what I just said here, although even there you'll find that it diverges in one direction. Okay, so any more questions? Okay, so everything we've done up till now has concerned insulating magnets. You had this notion that there were these moments at certain sites, and you were asking, okay, if they interact with one another through electrostatic interactions, what what kind of magnetic states are going to result. The Hubbard model was an attempt by Hubbard and others in the early 60s to try and understand magnetism in itinerants, and specifically ferromagnetism, although nowadays it's been deemed not sufficient to explain ferromagnetic properties. And it's used, as you may have heard over the years, it's used a lot to try and understand so-called strongly correlated electron systems and anti-ferromagnetic systems. So the Hubbard model, I can go through its origins in more detail, but because of lack of time, I won't. It involves a term that represents kinetic energy movement. It's called hopping. T is called the hopping term. So this moves from some site neighboring I to the site I and back forth. And then what you would like to include here is a term that represents Coulomb repulsion between these electrons, no matter where they are. So this is a density on site I and a density on site J, and Vij is some lattice representation of the Coulomb potential, which was like one of our minus R prime. Hubbard said this is too complicated, and so he said, look, the strongest Coulomb repulsion will occur when those two electrons are on the same site. And if they're on the same site and we're only considering a single orbital, then they have to be of opposite spin. So you're only going to deal with electrons that have opposite spin. So the idea is you've got a lattice, and you've got a spin guy there, another guy there, another down guy there, an up guy there, and somewhere along the ways you might have a doubly occupied site. So these can move. This cannot hop there because of the Pauli exclusion principle, but it could hop here, and then this would no longer be doubly occupied site, and so forth. And this represents the Coulomb interaction. Between electrons. So, to me, the best way of introducing you to some of the features of this model is to just run through. Yes.
Could it not hop and flip? Like, should we be concerned that that's not explicitly accounted for in the Hamiltonian?
Why do you say that?
I don't know.
It can, but not if what you have are Coulomb interactions. There's no hop and flip included in the Coulomb interactions. So I'm answering his question by asking him because I don't know how much detail I want to get into. The answer is yes, it can. But you know why? Because of something called spin orbit coupling. Okay, so there's something we haven't even discussed, which is spin orbit coupling, which is at the heart of topological insulators these days, for example. Spin orbit coupling is referred to as a relativistic effect, but as it appears in solids, it has nothing to do with approaching speed of light or anything like that. It's just an effect that comes out of reducing the Dirac Hamiltonian. I don't know, have you guys studied the Dirac Hamiltonian? Have you done this Foley-Wilson transformation where you reduce it down to the Schrödinger equation?
Oh,
okay, you can go, you can take the Dirac equations and say, ah, just kidding, nothing's relativistic here. We're you know, the momenta are not, the speeds are not fractions of the speed of light, so we're going to reduce it down to the Schrodinger equation. And when you do that, out pops spin. Okay, you didn't put spin in, but spin comes out. You sort of derive spin, in some sense, from the Dirac equation. But out pop a bunch of other terms. And one of those terms is an interaction between this newfound quantum entity called spin and the orbital angular momentum, so S dot L. So it's a spin orbit interaction, and it's the spin degrees of freedom, which you don't even know about. Like, if you're just doing Schrodinger, you've been trained over the years to stick to it, and even in this course, right? If we put spin in right from the very start, but we'll make no mistake about it, we just put it in, right? I didn't get it from anywhere. Whereas if you use the Dirac equation, it sort of magically appears. And along with it appears the spin orbit interaction. The spin orbit interaction says that when you now rewrite the spin orbit interaction in tight binding language, it says that there are going to be situations where the electron moves and the spin flips. So in that case, yes, you need a term that accounts for that if you want to utilize the spin orbit interaction. It's a problem I'm working on right now. It involves superconductivity in the presence of spin orbit interactions, and that there wouldn't need to be an additional term. I actually left out the spin here, but it's, as you realize, it's explicitly the same spin. So the guy moves from I plus delta to I with the same spin. There's no spin. Spin over interaction flips. There are other situations, even before spin orbit interactions became popular, if I study a model when there are not just normal garden variety impurities around, but there are actual magnetic impurities, the magnetic impurities interact with electrons in such a way that they tend to split the spin as well. So there are situations, but this is sort of the simplest of the simple that we're going to start with.
Yeah, I just was kind of wondering, because like, if you don't have the option to flip a spin, then that will be like a conserved quantity in
Absolutely.
Your dynamics. And then,
yep.
Like, how would you ever do any like simulation of this or something? Because like, you would have to pick an initial condition that could lead to states that are like equilibrium states that don't have the same number of spins as the, or spin up and spin down as your
Absolutely.
Initial conditions. Like,
absolutely. So in theory land, where I live, you use that to your advantage. So you solve each problem separately because it's a conserved quantity. We're gonna do that with this, we'll do that right now, so maybe it'll become clear. Yeah, Alan.
Yeah,
so Alan thinks we're cheating somehow because it's true that it does give us an advantage as theorists to solve this problem more readily. So let me jump right in, but before I jump right in, any other questions?
Is there a model like Pitai model?
Yeah.
It's just you can't flip the spin.
The time model is one, if I remember, that has been already covered. But the one that more people probably heard of is Roshba.
It's been already covered.
Okay. And let me emphasize, there is, Alan's pointed out something that's missing over on this side. There's a heck of a lot missing on this side. And I don't know how time will dictate, but next class I want to start superconductivity, and somewhere there maybe I will talk about what's missing beyond the hover time. So the way I feel I understood this best, and I'm hoping it's true for you guys, is to study the two-site model. Just the two-site model, and we'll do it exactly. So if there are two sites, how many states are there? Do you know how many states there are in this model?
Two to the two, four.
No, there's actually four to the two, so 16. Okay, so why are there 16? Because if I take one site, what can I have? I can have nothing. I can have a spin up. I can have a spin down. Or I can have both a spin up and spin down. And of course, I can do that for the others. So one of the states, for example, is going to be this, a spin up on each site. Or does everybody know what I mean by that state? Your warning. Question. If I draw that down, can you write down the state for me?
The superposition of half and half.
Pardon?
Just the superposition of the two states.
No. So this is site one, this is site two. And the idea is that this is supposed to be C1 up dagger, C2 up dagger acting on zero. Right? And what I'm asking is, if I told you this, can you just write this down? And the answer is no. Why? Yes. Now.
Yeah.
Yeah, the anti can be. What? How do I know I'm not talking about this thing? You say, oh, they're the same state. No, they're not. This is equal to minus that state. So yeah, they're the same state, but one of them has a minus sign. I better know what I'm talking about when I write down these states. Okay, so for states, I'm gonna use a convention. Two first and one second. By that I mean the state here is going to be like this. So when I say first, I mean the one closest to the back. Okay? Is that good enough? No, it isn't, right? What else do I need? I need up first and then down second. Because what if I have this state? There's no ambiguity. But what if I have this state? Why I say there's no ambiguity here is because you use the first rule, no matter what. So this one is C2 down dagger and C1 up dagger. So it seems in violation of the second, but the second is subject to the first. So first and foremost, we do this, and then two is this subject to the first. But for this state, the first rule doesn't come into play because there's only one site. So it's C2 up dagger, C2 down dagger. And I could have written it the other way around, but then there'd be a minus sign. But the second rule says do up first, then down. Okay. So, by the way, this is a problem with fermions. Okay, and not to be cynical, but this is why you will find a gazillion papers on boson models, because they don't want to have this headache. It's actually not a huge headache for these problems doing it the way I'm doing it now, but it's a big headache when you try to use quantum Monte Carlo. So when you do quantum Monte Carlo, there's a so-called Einstein problem whose origin is not understood, otherwise we would fix it, but undoubtedly goes back to these anti-commutation relations, and you run into problems simulating fermion systems. So when you can't come against up against the problem you can't solve, just solve another one. So the given that rule, I can enumerate all 16 states, and let me draw them schematically. I can draw them schematically if we understand these rules. And we've got zero, then we've got up, down, then we've got up, down, up, down, up, down, up, down. So there's six here, there's four here, and then I can do up, down, down, up, down, up, down, down, up, down, and up, down, up, down. So it's 4, 2, 4, 4, 1, 1, and hopefully that adds up to 16. So there's 16 states. So what am I going to do with this model? I'm going to take the wave function, and I'm going to write it in terms of these 16 basis states. With coefficients that I have to figure out. So those are the 16 basis states. I'm going to plug that into the Schrodinger equation, and then I'm going to get I'm going to get a matrix equation which looks like this, which in vector notation looks like that. Where this is a 16 by 16 matrix, and all it has are matrix elements which use these states, remember, things like this, and then I just put this one is the easy one, I put this operator in there, and I see that this state, for example, changes to this state, because that hopping term allows this to hop there, or the other state it changes to is this state, because that hopping term allows this to go over here. And this term is easy because the hopping term is zero, because I can't hop, because of the same spin. And so I have to diagonalize this 16 by 16 matrix. Except I don't, because I'm going to cheat the way Alan sort of pointed out. The first thing before we even get to spin is the number. This is CI up dagger, CI up, C down dagger, CI down. Every time I annihilate an electron, I create it back. This conserves number. It doesn't change the number. There's no reason that this state couples to any of these states. I can't just create a particle. So in fact, the 16 by 16 matrix is a 1 by 1 matrix, a 4 by 4 matrix, followed by a 6 by 6 matrix, followed by 4 by 4, 4 by 0 by 0. There's going to be symmetry too here, so like imagine. But then we can go further, right? There's the spin, because having observed that there's no spin flip in any of these terms, and you say, well, wait a minute, no, you can think of this guy as changing it up. Well, there's no spin flip in the sense that for every downspin you annihilate, you create one back. And for every upspin you annihilate, you create one back. So by the time you're through with operating on with everything here, you cannot have changed the second component of the spin. And similarly with this one. So that means that this this can't possibly couple to that. Right? So you're going to get two by two matrices there. And this can't possibly couple to any of the other ones because it's got a total spin 1, this has -1, and these have 0. So you got a 1 by 1, 1 by 1, and a 4 by 4. These are 2 by 2, and then that's 1 by 1. So now all of a sudden the biggest matrix you have is 4 by 4. If you wanted to cheat some more, you could transform this to momentum space, or wave vector space. If you went to wave vector space, then you would see in both terms, wave vectors conserved as well. Now, there's only two sites, but there are two wave vectors, 0 and pi. And so you would find that every single one of these, so the 2 by 2s are reduced to 1 by 1s, and this 4 by 4 reduces to 2 2 by 2s. So in the end, you only have to solve 2 by 2, which is something you can do. And I have to stop, but I don't want to. So I have to figure out what I want to do next time. I was planning to start superconductivity next lecture. I'll take probably 10 or 15 minutes at the beginning to just sort of carry on in this thing to tell you a little bit more about the other one. So we'll come back to this at the start of the next lecture, and then we'll move into superconductivity. Any questions before we disperse? Thank you.